Good evening, and welcome to the penultimate class for Discovering Buddhism. Last week I made an announcement about completion certificates for Discovering Buddhism, but not everybody was here last week, so I'm going to go through it again quickly. In order to get the final completion certificate for Discovering Buddhism, you need to complete the 13 modules, have one of these certificate of completions signed for each module. I'll talk to you about this in a second. And also complete the 14th module that's described on the FPMT Online Learning Center. It includes a Lama Rim retreat, 2-week Lama Rim retreat, 100,000 prostrations, and 100,000 Vajrasattva recitations, and some other stuff. So it's a serious undertaking, but it has been done. So what I am proposing, and it's my error, I had not been handing these out as you had your completion card signed by the instructor. So what I'm asking you to do, if you want one of these for each of the modules you've completed, bring in those completion cards that they signed for you. Bring them next week, and I will generate these for you, and we'll get Robbie and Don to sign them.
I'll sign them.
He will. He'll sign anything. But it's up to you to remember to bring them.
Bring your prescriptions.
Robbie, get your refills here. No. No, it's up to you to remember to bring them. But if you could bring them here, we will help you out. So that's it.
If other people do this, but sometimes I just open a book and it's the perfect page. So anyway, welcome to the next to the last class on Buddhist Tantra. And so far, we and every time I've taught this class before, I honestly think people have choked on the material. There's so much to say about Buddhist Tantra. It's just it's a vast subject. It's the I guess you could say it this way. It is kind of the crown jewel of Tibetan Buddhism, and yet we don't know much about it, do we? I mean, you know, you come here, we just talk about sutra. We don't really talk that much about Tantra, and because it's very demanding, and it's also it takes a lot of merit to have an opportunity to practice it and have a qualified teacher and so on. So it's and the preparation for successful Tantra practice is the sutra part of Tibetan Buddhism. We have a younger student here. She knows more than she lets on, but anyway. So I'm going to try to make this, palatable today. All right, let's start out with refuge and bodhicitta. Now I'm looking at the the things that you need to know. These are sort of the requirements for the course. I want to make sure we cover most of the stuff. Oh, by the way, next week, my hope is to do Dorje Khandro at the end of the class. Has anybody ever been here on Christmas Eve and we do Dorje Khandro? Raise your hand if you. Okay. So many of you have it, but anyway, it's a tantric purification practice, and we build a big fire, And I've got this great log I got at Whole Foods. It'll burn for hours, and we'll set the fire in the parking lot, and then we'll go outside and we'll do a little ceremony. And what you'll have a chance to do is, particularly, this is also very auspicious at the end of a retreat or at the end of discovering Buddhism, because this is the last class of this whole module of discovering Buddhism. So, you know, there's some negative karma that may have been accumulated, likely was. And so you want to let go of all of that stuff, all the negativities of body, speech, and mind. So it's a wonderful practice, because you can think of all the times in this and past lives that you've killed, and you give Dorji Khandro the black sesame seed. So there's a certain visualization. We'll set it up. But anyway, and we actually have an image of Dorji Khandro over here in the corner, that sort of wrathful tantric deity who just loves our negativities. Our negative, you know, when we offer Dorji Khandro negativities, his reaction to that is just bliss. He just loves it, because he loves taking our negativities and freeing us up. So let's start out, with a few minutes of meditation, and then turn to page 111 in the prayer book, the Gold Prayer Book. So sit up straight, both feet on the floor if you're sitting in a chair, and your hands in your lap, and you can close your eyes or just leave them slightly open, let a little light in, and then take about three exaggerated breaths, and as you exhale, just let all the tension out of your body. And now bring your attention to a single point. And I want you to, you can do this any number of ways, but one simple way to do it is just counting your breath. So you can breathe, you know, and you can focus on the rising and falling of your abdomen. You can focus just on the expansion of your chest. A lot of people like to focus on the sensation of the breath at the tip of the nose. It just really depends upon you. But whatever it is, it's always changing, isn't it? The breath is coming and going. So you want to not lose it even for a moment. But as you breathe out, you know, breathe out, you breathe, you say one, and then breathe in two, and out three. So we'll do that 10 times together, and then and then you can continue. So let's breathe in, one, out two, in three, out four, in five, out six, in seven, out eight, in nine, out ten. And then you can can start over at one, or you can just continue to count. It's really easy for your mind to wander, so if it does, just bring it back and start over at one. So the crucial thing to understand before thinking about and meditating on and really embarking on the tantric path is to understand the three principles of the path, the three principal aspects of the path. And we talked about this. You know, throughout discovering Buddhism, it comes up and up and up. It comes up again so many times, and it's sometimes a little hard to remember specifically what they are. I think those of you who've been here for a while do know what they are, but I'll just review them again. And it said, the teachers say that you don't actually have to have a realization of these three principal aspects of the path, but you have to have a feeling, some sort of intellectual understanding, and have developed some heartfelt experience of the meaning of these three principles of the path. And so the first one is renunciation. Renunciation. Excuse me, I have a cold. Renunciation is this. You know, sometimes people, I have said it. It really is having compassion for yourself. You're having compassion for yourself, realizing that, you know, we have, you know, we're caught in this. In this life where things are pretty much out of our control. You know, you can't tell your body to not get old. You can't tell yourself to be happy when you're miserable. You know, things happen and they will continue to happen throughout our lives. So we're caught in this process of uncontrolled causation. And yet, the Buddha is saying, it is possible to be free of suffering. Now, our biggest obstacle to even starting this path is we don't think we have that capability. We don't really in our heart of hearts think, oh, maybe somebody else can do it, but not me. I'm this ordinary person with this ordinary body and ordinary mind. I can't I'm not capable of being free of suffering. But this is what renunciation is really means. It's this determination to be free. And you have to believe it's possible. Otherwise, why would you determine it? You have to believe in yourself, in your own Buddha nature. And here's where the teachers come in. They're so helpful because we can see in our teachers, particularly the ones that are spiritually evolved, that they have extraordinary qualities. And we can see that they are free of something that we would call suffering. You know, if we get to know a qualified teacher well, it's very inspiring for our practice. It's so important to meet and get to know a qualified master, teacher. So the first step on the path is having enough compassion for yourself to make a heartfelt determination to be free of suffering and its causes. Wouldn't it be great to not suffer? Wouldn't it be great to be so happy? Unimaginably happy. Wouldn't that be great? And then make a determination. I am going to be free of suffering and achieve, you know, my full potential. I'm determined to be free. Okay? And then the second principle of the path is bodhicitta. Again, bodhi means awakening or awakened. Citta means mind. So awakening mind, and it's what distinguishes the greater vehicle, the universal vehicle that we call Mahayana, which you know, is Tibetan Buddhism and Zen and Chan Buddhism, the northern schools of Buddhism primarily, is this attitude that we we want to help others, and the best way to help others is to help ourselves. Kind of interesting. The best way to help others is to help ourselves. And the best way to help ourselves is to help others. So someone who's done all the, you know, we talk about the six cause and one effect practices to develop bodhicitta that came down to the lineage of Atisha, and then Shantideva's lineage of exchanging self for others. There are different ways, methods to develop it, because this thought of achieving our full potential, that is enlightenment, solely for the sake of others. I'm going to do this for others. That's the attitude. I'm going to go for enlightenment so I can help others, so I can truly make a difference. I'm going to eliminate my faults, develop my good qualities for the sole purpose of being a perfect guide, a perfect example, a perfect leader, to be able to serve and help others in whatever way it best suits the individual. So you can see right away, that attitude is so antithetical. It's the opposite of our ordinary self-centered mind. But it's so powerful. It is the mind, this mind of enlightenment is what makes enlightenment possible. Bodhicitta. Without bodhicitta, there's no possibility for enlightenment. There are no bodhisattvas. There's no Vajrayana. Vajrayana is a joke. I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but to practice Vajrayana without bodhicitta becomes poisonous. So very important to have an open-hearted bodhicitta motivation as much as we can. So we talked about renunciation, determination to be free, bodhicitta, this open-hearted dedication to achieve an enlightenment for the benefit of others. And then the final point is called the wisdom of emptiness. And one of the ways to think about it is to just imagine that in front of you is a blank canvas. And that's really all there is. And that your mind is the projector. Our mind is the projector. There's not one thing that we see, hear, smell, taste, or touch, or think that exists the way it appears to our mind. It seems to have some existence out there, independent of our mind. But no, nothing could possibly exist that way. Everything depends upon our mind. So it's as if our mind is a projector and there's a blank screen. This is just one way to access this concept. And our mind is projecting our reality. If we're happy, where did that movie come from? I want to see that movie again. If we're miserable and depressed or sick or dying, whatever, where did that movie come from? I don't want to see that movie again. Where did it come from? It came from our own former actions of body, speech, and mind. The karmic seeds, because things don't exist independently, inherently, out there, independent of our mind projecting it, because they don't exist that way. Where's the projector coming from? Where's the film coming from? Coming from our own former actions. If we want to see ourselves as happy, we practice virtue. We avoid killing, stealing, adultery, lying, slander, harsh, frivolous talk, greed, hatred, and ignorance, and the 84,000 other delusions, right? We try to keep our mind in virtue. That plants the seeds for the projector to force us to see ourselves as happy. When you're happy, you can't be miserable. You can't make yourself, well, you could, with a little bit of time, but in the moment the mind is happy, you can only do one thing at a time. So if we want our mental projector to project happiness, then our actions have to, the little screen, because now we're in the digital age, so we don't use film anymore, but what's creating the image of happiness is our own virtuous actions of body, speech, and mind. And what creates the image or the story of suffering and sadness and limiting beliefs and all the suffering that we can imagine, birth, sickness, old age, and death, it's all coming from our informer actions. Of body, speech, and mind, non-virtuous ones. So, killing, stealing, adultery, lying, slander, harsh, frivolous, greed, hatred, and ignorance. Actions motivated by those minds always lead to suffering. Actions motivated by the opposites always lead to happiness. Again, this is so sort of the real practical aspect of emptiness. Because there is no objective reality independent of my mind, everything I perceive depends upon my mind. And my perceptions depend upon my former actions virtue forces me to see myself as happy in paradise, maybe one day. And non-virtue forces me, through the laws of karma, to see myself as unhappy. And the good news is we can purify negative karma and we can collect more positive karma. We can weed the garden and plant the flowers, as Venerable Rabina said. So this is emptiness is the wisdom aspect of the teachings of the Buddha. So important. So important. And sometimes people say, well, if things, some people hear, well, nothing exists, which is wrong. We're not saying that. We're just saying it doesn't exist the way it appears. And then some people say, well, how can compassion exist? I mean, you know, if it's just all our mind, where does compassion come from? And it's said that if you understand emptiness well, it only enhances your compassion. Why? Why do you think that's so? If you understand how our mind creates our suffering based on our own former actions, if you understand how we see something, we see somebody, we say, oh, I hate that person, and we get negative, and we might even harm them. We buy into our projections. We don't question them. We believe in them. We react to them. It creates more and more suffering. Someone who has the view of emptiness, of wisdom, sees how sentient beings, all living beings, are drawn in to suffering because of this misperception of reality. And it literally, I'm not going to say breaks a Buddha's heart, because Buddhas can have compassion without being sad, but it's very sad to see how we're all get sucked in to our view of reality, believe in it, and then creates all kinds of problems for ourselves and others. So understanding compassion only enhances, I mean understanding wisdom enhances our compassion. So these are the three principles of the path. These are like, this is the ticket to any tantric, well, this plus refuge. You have to have confidence, not only in the tantric teachings, but you'll also have to have made a commitment to the Buddhist path to actually take an empowerment, which is a ceremony that gives you permission to practice. And so we're going to do the refuge and bodhicitta prayer in just a minute. But I want to revisit really quick what we talked about last week about refuge. So refuge has three things just to reflect on briefly before we take refuge. The first one is fear. Bottom line is fear. It's like, wow, I don't, with the kind of mind I have, the future does not look good. I'm afraid of that. I don't like it. I dread, you can use the word dread if you want to. It makes you feel better. But I'm afraid of what's going to happen to me with the kind of mind I have. You know? I want to stop that. So this dread, fear of what's going to happen in the future with a mind that's basically out of control. Basically out of control. You know, problems come again and again. You know, if the meeting leads to parting. Everything is in a constant state of degeneration. And then eventually we get old, sick, and die. It's going to happen to everybody. Can you handle it? With dignity and calmness and joy and freedom and bliss? Or will you freak out? That's a real important question to ask yourself. We all need to ask ourselves that. Most of us probably won't do that well. So having some dread for the consequences of our living a future with an uncontrolled mind, and then confidence that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the three jewels, can actually teach us how to maintain our composure no matter what the situation is, to eliminate our faults and develop our good qualities. So it's, you know, sometimes we use the word confidence, but there's a strong element of faith. Faith in the Dharma, in the teachers, and in the spiritual community. And probably the most important of all is the teachers. Even though we ultimately take refuge in the Dharma, the teachers really inspire us by their example. So now we've got this dread or fear of the kind of living our lives out with the kind of minds we have, and faith or confidence in that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha can indeed guide us, you know, away from this craziness to not only just peace, you know, a little bit of relief, but actually joy and freedom, nirvana, enlightenment, all the way to the top of the mountain. And now, it takes confidence. It takes faith, because honestly, we don't think we can do it, do we? So there is a little, you know, faith is not a bad word here. We've got to have some faith and confidence that we can do it. That's what refuge is all about. And then compassion. Compassion for ourselves, compassion for others. You know, by taking refuge and realizing the teachings of the Buddha, we can stop our own suffering and the suffering of others. So that's compassion. So it's good to try to remind yourself again and again whenever we do these refuge prayers. Just if we just blurt them out without thinking about the meaning, not helpful. Not very helpful. So let's do these... taking refuge in the three jewels on page 111, and then we'll do the four measurables and then motivation for life. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were able to live in equanimity, free from hatred and attachment, not holding some close and others distant. May they abide in equanimity. I myself will cause them to abide in equanimity. Please, Guru Deity, bless me to be able to do this. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings had happiness and the causes of happiness. May they have happiness and the causes of happiness. I myself cause them to have these. Please, Guru Deity, please bless me to be able to do this. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were free from suffering and its causes. May they be free from suffering and its causes. I myself will cause them to be free from suffering and its causes. Please, Guru Deity, bless me to be able to do this. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were never separated from the happiness of higher rebirth and liberation. May they never be separated from these. I myself will cause them never to be separated from these. Please, Guru Deity, bless me to be able to do this. The purpose of my life is to free all sentient beings from every suffering and lead them to happiness, especially the sublime, peerless happiness of full enlightenment. Since the enjoyments of my everyday life, every past, present, and future happiness, including enlightenment, are dependent on future sentient beings, the happiness of these numberless sentient beings depends on me. If I generate loving kindness towards sentient beings, then all sentient beings will receive no harm from me, and instead will have peace and success. Therefore, I am responsible for all sentient beings' happiness and peace. I am a servant here to serve every sentient being without discriminating between those who harm and those who help, whatever they do. For the success of this, I must achieve full enlightenment. Therefore, I am going to put all of my actions of my body, speech, and mind in virtue so that I can be of the greatest benefit to all sentient beings, which means to achieve enlightenment as quickly as possible. May all these actions not cause the slightest harm, but bring only benefit to all sentient beings in the best way, so that they too may as quickly as possible achieve enlightenment. Any questions about anything in discovering Buddha? I'm just kidding. Robbie's here, so you can answer them. About Tantra specifically. Any questions about Tantra? Yeah.
This has more about initiation.
Okay.
Like, for instance, when people go for initiations, like for the Kali Chakra initiation, does it like take 2 days or something like that? Does the Dalai Lama then become your teacher if he's giving it? Or how does that work? Then do you come back and do you already have a teacher and then you come back and they help you through the whole thing? I'm just trying to figure out how all this works.
Are you going to take the Kali Chakra?
No.
Right? Have you done it?
Heck no.
Next question. Okay, so this is a good question. If you take a tantric empowerment from any teacher, this gets tricky, particularly in Hastyoga Tantra, where the relationship between the guru, right, the lama, the guru, and the student is really, really important, because you're promising to see this person as a Buddha. So if he comes into the room and picks you up and carries you outside and throws you out the door, and you go, wait a minute, that's not how a Buddha is supposed to behave. And you know, now you might get angry and, you know, try to duke it out with him, but you know, well, you go, wow, this could be a she, by the way. This, you know, the Buddha's male, Buddhas don't have any, anyway. So what are you going to do with that? In other words, you have to be willing, because sometimes the teachers are wrathful. I mean, really tough, because that's the medicine you need. So when you take an empowerment from anyone, you are saying that I've checked this person out, this is a practice that I'm interested in doing, and I am choosing to see them as perfect. Every action, you know, when, for example, Lama Zopa is one of my gurus, you know. Now, are you going to the retreat in the mountains? Yeah. So when you get there, you're going to hear a lot of this rocking back and forth, and, you know, cleaning his throat, you know, clearing his throat and stuff like that. And you can go, well, you know, obviously he didn't read Dale Carnegie's book on how to win friends and influence people, you know, because this is not how you're supposed to do it. But he's like doing it. You know, he might show up late. He might stay late. I mean, he's completely unpredictable, completely. And so, you know, I'll give you a quick example. This is Robbie. in the Ravi's introduction, Lama Zopa. This is back 1980? Was it 80?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 81. Yeah. So, right, you know, I met Lama Zopa in 1978 in Nepal. And Lama Yeshe had told me to go back and redo the November course, this four-week course, Lam Rim course in Kathmandu. So Ravi and I were in the same training program, and I told Ravi I was going back to Nepal. Ravi said, I'll go. Ravi jumped in. And so, you know, it was unprecedented. Right in the middle of his residency, he took 6 weeks off, but he got by with it. And so we were there, and Lama Zopa was teaching on Shantideva's text on patience, the six chapters on patience, tolerance, patience. You get what I mean by patience? Like not getting angry, not getting annoyed. Well, guess what he did for at least half, if not two-thirds of the course? He just taught the same thing over and over again. I'm telling you, people were getting so mad, you wouldn't believe it. But, I mean, Ravi and I, at one point, we went, oh my God, he's teaching us, he's giving us an experiential treatment, a teaching on patience. You know, this is not just how to do it, a list of 10 things to do. This is like, you sit here with me for the next 3 weeks while I teach the same four lines over and over again and keep your mind, you know, in a good place. Now, he got through some material, but it was very repetitive, and a lot of people got annoyed. And when we kind of figured out what was going on, it was really quite fun, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was great teaching. But if you thought that it was supposed to, if you had expectations, you would have been very unhappy. So, you know, I think that's how you try to, whatever a guru teaches, you try to see it as something for your mind. So if a guru picks you up and throws you out the door, you go, wow, must be a lesson here for me, you know?
But like that. How do you... If you're taking an initiation from a teacher, say Lama Zopa, and, you know, he's not going to show up, you're not going to be able to have contact with him frequently.
No.
So and from what I've read, that's important, the relationship and what you said, and they guide you through your practice. But if that person is there, or if you say you've taken initiation from the Dalai Lama, I mean, certainly you aren't going to be sitting down one-on-one with him. How does that...
That's a good question. And what happens is that, you know, again, in a perfect world, you would be taking an initiation with a small group of people, and you would have a personal relationship with your guru. But in reality, millions and millions of people have taken initiations. I'm going to say millions. I'm not talking millions and millions, but many, many, many people have taken initiations from the Dalai Lama, and they consider him their guru, but they don't get a chance to sit down and talk to him. But you can still visualize him as your guru and see him as a Buddha, but then get advice from Geshe Gelug. I mean, yeah. So you can get on how to do the practices and stuff like that, but you don't necessarily... you may or may not be able to speak to Lama Zopa and make a connection with him one-on-one, but there's a lot of things written, and Geshe Gelug is his proxy, you might say.
Yeah. How do you decide what deity you want to...
You know, that's a good question, too, and I think...
I've been thinking about all these things.
You know, it really depends. I think in a perfect world, Your teacher, but again, you can't go up to the Dalai Lama and say, hey, which deity should I practice? And so, you know, you could ask Geshe Gelug. He might give you some ideas. He can do some certain kinds of divinations and practices to try to see which deity you have the strongest karmic connection with. And in a practical way, like, for example, if you're extremely dull-minded, you know, I'm not picking on you, but, you know, Manjushri, where's Manjushri? I don't see him. Anyway, Manjushri is this Buddha figure, and he's holding the sword of wisdom, right, in his hand, which is to cut through ignorance, right? And so to develop wisdom, there's a mantra, Omarapasana Di, that you would want to do. Now, if you were particularly prone to anger, you know, and impatience and those kinds of things, compassion's a really good antidote to anger, isn't it? So what deity might you want to do there? Chinrezig, yeah. So you may be drawn to Green Tara, you know? Om Tari Tu Tari Tari Soha. That's her mantra. And there's a whole practice. I think tonight we may have some time to do a form Chinrezig practice. I'd like to work that in. But so different deity practices. Now we're really talking about the lowest level of Tantra. In Tibetan Buddhism, mostly what gets practiced is the lower level called Kriya or Action Tantra, and then highest Yoga Tantra. So for example, if you're a person who's kind of, you know, has a lot of passions and all this kind of stuff, and it's a big distraction and a big problem, then for example, you may end up, usually in highest Yoga Tantra, you ask your guru for a deity. They might pick Haruka or Vajrayogini. Okay? Again, to develop wisdom, there's one deity that's used a lot to help develop wisdom, but it's kind of fierce wisdom. It's not what we call, you know, idiot wisdom, but it's like a fierce wisdom. And it's Yamantaka. And we don't have any pictures. We don't have any highest Yoga Tantra images in here. We got the statue of Kalachakra, but that's it. And then there's Guhya Samaja. The three big ones in the Gelug tradition are Yamantaka, which has to do with wisdom, Haruka, which has to do with passion, transforming that energy, and then Guhya Samaja has some esoteric practices that I can't really explain. Those are the three main highest Yoga Tantra deities in our tradition. And then Kalachakra, which is called the king of tantras. But everything in Tantra, the colors, the implements in the hands, everything has symbolic meaning. Literally blueprints to transform our mind. You know, I was talking a little bit earlier today about, like, you know, if you're going to build a building, first of all, before you build a building, you know, and let's say you've never built a building, you go, I can't build a building. I don't have the capability of doing that. But let's say you get trained up a little bit. You go to school, you learn how to draw architectural drawings, right? Then you get the details of the drawings. You get all the details, the electrical and the HVAC and the physical structure of the building and the materials and everything. It's all laid out. Then you get the blueprint, very much like the tantric, you know, when we visualize ourselves, for example, we might do a self. I'll talk about self visualization and front visualization because you can do both. But let's say we're going to use a front visualization of Chinrezig. So it's like a blueprint for compassion. All right. Then you can build the building. Once you get the blueprint, you can build the building, and you can make really good quick progress at that point to build the building, right? But up until then, we're just grappling at trying to figure out how to make this work. But in Tantra, we visualize the future result, which is our enlightenment as Chinrezig or Tara or Manjushri or whatever deity we've chosen to visualize ourselves as. We imagine that we're that now. Okay? And that helps speed our evolution in that direction. And it's one of the features of Tantra is that we call it the resultant path. We take the future result, which is our enlightenment, and imagine that we're that now. But the key is, when we say, I'm that now, it's not this one. It's not like Dawn. It's like we have to let go of our story of like that I'm incapable. We have to be able to dissolve our ordinary sense of I into emptiness and let it go. You get what I'm saying? You know, we recognize that our mind projects, yeah, I mean, there is an I, right? There's a body and a mind. That's me. Okay? But then ignorance projects a sense of I want that. I hate that. I. It's this false I, this hallucinated I that we believe and cherish and will kill for, right? That I is the one that we need to let go and disappear. And then motivated by wisdom and compassion, we arise as Chenrezig, the perfect manifestation of compassion. Body made of light, you know, every action of Chenrezig's body, speech, and mind designed only to help us develop compassion. Right? So this is this is real simplistic, but this is kind of the way my mind thinks about it. So Tantra is, again, taking the future result and imagining that we are that now. But to visualize yourself as the deity, you have to have had permission from a qualified tantric master. You're not supposed to do that without that permission. Otherwise, it could go bad. Remember we talked about you really need to be grounded in the three principles of the path. You need to be sane. You can't be, not that sane, but, you know, sane enough. I told you about this story about I'm not going to say it again, but, you know, the lady, I mean, people who are not ready for Tantra, I've seen it happen when I was in India. Some things didn't go well. And so you really have to have your head on straight. And I'm not necessarily saying I do, because tantric practices are way more challenging than sutra tantric practices. Way more challenging. Yes?
Is the deity picked for what your strength is, or what the guru thinks you need?
I think it's more what your guru thinks you need to develop. You know, I mean, yeah, what you need. Because, you know, we talk about enlightened beings as being, you know, having perfect wisdom and compassion and power and skillful means, right? And then there's many other qualities to an enlightened being. But skillful means to know exactly, to be able to look at somebody and literally to read their karma like that. To know exactly what their propensities are and exactly what their, you know, areas where they might be vulnerable, and to know exactly what to say and do to help that being realize their potential. That's what a really great qualified guru can do. This is the teachings. And, you know, if you meet somebody like that, you're really lucky in this lifetime. But it's a huge advantage on the path to have a qualified guru who gets you and can help guide you. That was a long-winded answer. Any other questions? Yeah.
I have a simpler question. I think along the lines of being asked to do 100,000 recitations or 100,000 prostrations, what's the purpose of that? Is that to prove your dedication to the path, or is that to clean your mind and get ready? There are other things you're going to do, or what?
I think it's all of those. I think, first of all, you wouldn't do it if you didn't have faith in your teachers. I mean, 100,000 prostrations. I wouldn't do it
doctor.
Pardon?
I need faith in my doctor if I'm going to do that.
Yeah, really. You need to, you know, go get a stress test. But it takes faith. You really need to have confidence in your teacher, and then we say to, for tantric practice to be successful, there has to be a lot of purification and accumulation. Alright? So we need to purify our mind and accumulate as much positive potential as we can. And so these practices, I mean, they call them the nundro. In the Kagyu tradition and Nyingma tradition, the nundro is, usually it's like four things. It's 100,000 refuge, refuge recitations, which are four lines. It's 100,000 Vajrasattva mantras, the 100-syllable mantra. It takes anywhere from 2.5 to 3 months to do that, and that's doing it mostly every, you know, four times a day. That's a big commitment. Unless you're going to stretch it out. You can also do it over years, but in a retreat, it would take between, I've heard it done in, Lama Zopa did it in 2 weeks, but then he doesn't sleep. Other people do it in 6 weeks, in 3 months. 3 months is usually the length of time. So then 100,000 mandala offerings and 100,000 guru yogas, recitations. So that's just four, for the Kagyu and the Kagyu Nyingma. Then they say, when you've done that and you understand the three principles of the path, then you're ready to practice, to get an empowerment and practice Tantra. In the Gelugpa tradition, the Nundro is, I think, it might be 12 different things. It's 100,000 water bowl offerings. It's 100,000 Dorji Kadra offerings that we're going to do next time. It's 100,000 satsas, 100,000 light offerings. It's 100,000 of a lot of things. And it takes a long time. And I have some friends that have done that. Before they went into a long retreat, they did the full, nundra to prepare their mind, to purify their mind and to accumulate positive potential. And you can imagine, to do that, you'd have to have incredible commitment. So to do a long retreat, that's what it takes. But the long retreat is where the real work on the mind gets done. Kadabha said we do our best, but this is really lightweight. This is Dharma light. Sorry, Robbie.
He's straightening up his tie.
Robbie's doing him.
That's doing the whole practice, the short practice.
Yeah.
Not just reciting the mantra.
No, it's the whole practice. You do the sadhana, and then you recite a certain number of mantras each time. You were at the summer retreat, right? Yeah. Okay, so we're almost out of time. Not really, but close to it. Any other questions about anything? Okay. So there's a couple of things I want. I tell you, it can sometimes be bewildering to talk about Tantra and try to make it palatable. But I think I've talked about the things that I wanted to talk about. I'm going to go over some of the things that were really on part of the quiz, but you're not going to get this quiz. But I'm going to mention the questions that are on the quiz. First of all, Lama Yeshe gave the first question has to do with the three principal aspects of the path, right? And Lama Yeshe used the words emerging, opening, and dissolving. Emerging would be what? Emerging would be renunciation. Emerging, like the determination to be free. Emerging from, our addiction to our suffering. Okay? And then opening would have to do with opening our heart and our mind, all beings. That's bodhicitta. And then dissolving would be dissolving our ordinary sense of self. Okay? So, It's really important. Every tantric sadhana. Now these are all sadhanas. I got like five of them here, and they're just little meditation, guided meditation manuals for different deity practices, and they're also, the term sadhana means method of accomplishment, like that. So, for example, there's a thousand-armed Shinrezig and there's a four-armed Shinrezig. So we're going to try to do this in just a few minutes. But, and since probably not many people here have had an initiation into this practice, you're not going to see yourself as the deity this time. But I'm just going to tell you what you do if you did. So if you had an initiation into the deity, into Shinrezig practice, you would, in the ritual part, and I'll tell you, I didn't like the ritual part. I did Vajrasattva retreat many years ago, and I didn't like ritual at all. And I thought, this is not my thing. And yet, you know, about a week into it, I was going, thank God for the ritual, because it really helped my mind to stay on track, and it also helps to purify the mind and accumulate some merit and get some momentum going, so that when you get into the actual practice, you can be successful. So ritual is really important. So every tantric practice has some readings and visualizations and rituals and prayers and offerings, and you know, you ring in the bell and doing all, playing the little Damaru drum and stuff like that, and it's all kind of interesting and looks exotic, but it's not, it really has deep meaning. So then you get to the point where let's say Shinrezig, who's inseparable from your guru that gave you the empowerment. You visualize maybe Shinrezig with, let's say, four arms, and it comes to the crown of your head, completely made of light, inseparable from your guru, and Shinrezig dissolves through the crown of your head and dissolves down into your heart. Okay? And then you imagine that your body, you know, almost like in is it Star Wars where they used to say beam me up, you know, Star Trek, yeah, your body just starts, all the atoms of your body just begin to, you know, vibrate, and you get smaller and smaller and smaller, and then you dissolve into your heart and then completely disappear. So your physical form completely disappears into the space of emptiness. So what appears is spaciousness, and what you're aware of is emptiness, which is what we talked about. This lack of true, independent, inherent existence. It's kind of hard to do this, but we do the best we can. And then from the space of emptiness, because you don't want to emanate your ego, do you? So we got to let go of our ego. And motivated by compassion to liberate all sentient beings. Because remember, the only reason to practice Tantra is because we all know that Tantra is fast, right? It's the fastest, most powerful method to transform our mind and to get enlightened. So who wants the fast train? Who wants the rowboat? No, I want the fast train. I want the fastest. The only reason to want the fastest is because you cannot bear the suffering of sentient beings any longer. You've got to get there as quick as you can. Get your act together. Get enlightened as fast as possible. So motivated by compassion and wisdom, poof, you imagine that you rise as Shinrezig now. And you think, and you visualize yourself with, let's say, you know, how many faces? Looks like just one here. The one face, four arms. And each, everything, there's a flower in one hand, and there's a crystal rosary. Everything has symbolic meaning. And here you are, and you go, I am Shinrezig. And we're labeling our, not our ego I, but our nominal I is labeled as Shinrezig. You go, I am Shinrezig now. I'm the Buddha of compassion. I am the perfect emanation of wisdom and compassion. Now. and you try to develop what's called clear appearance of yourself as the deity and divine pride. It's called divine pride. It's not afflictive pride. It's like I am the Buddha of compassion. You know, not like I'm the Buddha of compassion, but I am the Buddha of compassion. So it's called divine pride. And a clear appearance of yourself as a deity. And it's really, and so you try and cultivate that for a moment. Feeling good about yourself, right? Not, ordinarily, what's the story we have about ourselves? I'm limited, I can't, I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not pretty enough, I'm not young enough, I'm too old, I'm too young enough. I mean, limit. I can't get enlightened, I can't be happy, I can't have, you know, we're never satisfied. All of that's gone, and now I am completely blissed out. Chinrezig, the manifestation of all the Buddha's compassion. And so you develop divine pride in being Chinrezig now. And you hold that feeling. It's really a good feeling, isn't it? Think about it. You're identifying with, but it's not just fiction, is it? Because we all have the seed of wisdom, compassion, don't we? We all have some compassion. We have a little bit. That's our Buddha nature. So all we've done is expanded what we already have and imagining that we're that now, fully cultivated. Okay? And so we have some compassion, but now it's fully developed. And so we imagine that. And then at some point you would imagine a mundus at your heart and the syllable hri, H-R-I-H, at the center of that, and around the edges of the mundus is this Om Mani Padme Hum, the mantra of Chinrezig. And you would imagine if you were doing this practice, you'd have your mala, or you don't have to have mala anymore because we got counters now, or you can use your cell phone. You just hit a button. But anyway, so you want to keep up with your... Usually you try to keep up with the number of mantras that you do. So, you know, you go, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. And as you say that, the each word of the mantra kind of lights up and sends out, I mean, there are different visualizations that different gurus would, so I can't tell you what other, but you know, different visualizations, but oftentimes you're emanating little mini Chinrezigs, you know, the Buddha of compassion, who's going out to the furthest reaches of the universe, who's going out to help Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and whoever else is out there that needs help right now. Going out and helping all the people in ISIS and the victims and the people with diseases and the animals and the beings in all the different realms of existence, all the way from the peak of samsara, the God realm, the inside the Beltline people, down to the, you know, to the hell realms. A whole spectrum of beings in samsara. You know, we're emanating little Chinrezigs going out, and that you can, and you try to imagine that the Chinrezigs are like people with AIDS are cured, and people with sadness and depression are cured, and people who've lost a loved one, their grief is like immediately disappears, and people with cancer are cured, and people, any kind of suffering you can imagine, you imagine is resolved, and then you absorb Chinrezig back into your heart, and as you're saying the mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, you send them out again, and they do their job, and you're practicing being a Buddha now, because this is what Chinrezig does. Chinrezig, you know, is like that. So we're it's a dress rehearsal for our future enlightenment. We're practicing being that now. Okay, that's kind of a just a quick, you know, view of how that might go. There's one point that's very confusing to me, so I thought I would confuse you with it too. You know, we talk about in Tantra the different levels of mind, okay? I mean, right now, the level of mind that we're using is what? Pretty gross, isn't it? This is gross mind. Then the mind when we're dreaming at night is more subtle, okay? And some great yogis, and I don't have an S on this over this, but I've heard people say he is kind of a master of dream yoga. Because you want to be able, if you can, you know, have you ever had lucid dreaming when you were dreaming and you knew you were dreaming? Like that? All of us probably had a moment of it like that. Well, what if you could do that all the time, at will? Whenever you went into the dream state, you just got behind the wheel of that car called, you know, Buddy Cheetah, and you drove it wherever you wanted to, and you saw yourself doing all the actions of a Buddha, like that. So it's a subtle level of mind. And then, so subtle means powerful. The most powerful level of mind, the most subtle level of mind, is called a clear light mind. Okay? For most human beings, it's the mind that we experience at the time of death. But it's possible through advanced tantric, highest yoga tantra, yogic techniques to access the subtlest level of mind and use that to meditate on reality and cut through eons of negative karma and develop all the positive merit we need to get enlightened in this lifetime. But the key is accessing the subtlest clear light mind. And to do that, it takes an enormous skill and purification and virtue. Okay? And one of the reasons that they say that Tantra is more powerful, instead of, this may be the reason, although I don't have this experience, but they say, in Buddhism we say there are two wings to the bird, right? What are the wings?
Wisdom
and compassion, right? Wisdom and compassion. And in the sutra vehicle, we develop wisdom and compassion that develop sequentially. You know, your wisdom helps enhance your compassion, and your compassion helps us create merit and positive potential so we can have a direct intuitive insight into wisdom. Okay, so they work together, but they're not in the same moment of mind. And for some reason, and I cannot explain it, but in Tantra, it's said to be the reason Tantra is so fast and so powerful, is that we can have method and we can have wisdom and compassion in the same moment of mind. Wisdom and compassion in the same moment of mind. And it has to do with deity yoga and visualizing ourself as a deity, which is the manifestation of all the method of the Buddha, and seeing the emptiness of the deity all at the same time. So, I can't explain it any better than that. I just want to throw it out there, something, you'll hear it again, that it's only in Tantra that you can combine wisdom and compassion in the same moment of mind, and it is the reason that Tantra is like the light, is the fast path. And there are many other reasons I've mentioned, but this is said to be like one of the key ones. Okay. This thing is acting up. Okay, so let's stretch for a second, and we'll do a little chin raising practice, and I'll write the mantras. Hannah, would you write the mantra on the board, please? Om Mani Padme Hum. Right there. I know. Can we cut the air conditioner on in here?
You want it a little cooler?
I don't want it hotter.
Pretty good.
There's the hot hells and then there's the cold hells. So if you have black sesame seeds next week, if you could bring them, would anybody take on going to the Chinese market and buying? We don't need a lot, you know, just a little cup. We need a little plastic cup. Will you? Okay, good. They're not terribly expensive. Yeah, and the cups as well. And I'll bring the. I've got the fire pit at my house, although I think they have one here, and I got a great log. And by the time we, we'll start the fire a little early.
Does the class start at 6:30?
I think we're going to start at 6:30 because the party starts at 8:00. The celebration. So we'll have. All right, very good. Thank you. All right, let's sit them back down. Now I'm gonna. We probably won't spend a lot of time on any major point, but I did want to go through this sadhana one time. So just bring your attention to. To your breath and focus on the again you can count if that works for you, or just focus on the sensation of the breath. So ideally, we would have received an empowerment by a qualified tantric master into this practice. We would definitely have some heartfelt feeling for renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness. And just by doing these tantric practices, it'll enhance the three principles of the path. They'll grow immensely from doing the practice. So we don't have to have a fully realized renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness, because they'll get stronger and stronger the more tantric practice we do. And then we're doing this practice because we want to get enlightened as quickly as possible. Why? So we can help stop the suffering and guide others from whatever state of confusion they're in now to supreme enlightenment, to the highest happiness possible. And that's a great motivation to start a tantric practice. So since we've already done Refuge in Bodhicitta, but I will read it, just do it one time. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my merit, from giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. And now there's the four immeasurables, and I won't read these completely through, but there's immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion, immeasurable joy, and immeasurable equanimity. And then the special refuge, again, Tantra emphasizes the guru don't hear so much emphasis in sutra, but in tantra it's a big deal. So it's the special refuge. To my root guru, the quintessence of all refuge objects, I go for refuge. Please bless my mind with your transforming powers. Now here's the visualization of Chinrezig. Now you can't see this is just forearm Chinrezig, but I'll show you what this looks like. Just look up here. It's very beautiful. Usually the image is of a 16-year-old, completely made of light. There's no flaws whatsoever. And this Chinrezig has a crown on his head, and at his heart, he's holding a wish-fulfilling jewel. Okay? It's a mythical jewel that can bring, you know, whatever you want for the benefit of others can come true. Sometimes the real wish-fulfilling jewel is all sentient beings, because it's in dependence upon them that we can get enlightened. So Chinrezig has the wish-fulfilling jewel in his heart. In his right hand, he's holding a crystal rosary. In his left hand, he's holding a lotus flower. Okay? See, again, it's not so important that you visualize all that, but that's what's happening. Above the crown of my head and above the crowns of all sentient beings, infinite is space, so we're surrounded by universal living beings in human form. Above my head and their head is a white lotus and a moon disc. Upon this appears the white letter Hri, H-R-I-H, which transforms into the protector, my root guru, Chinrezig. So instantly Chinrezig arises above the crown of our head in this body of light, again holding a wish-fulfilling jewel, smiling, compassionate, gentle smile on his face, crystal rosary right hand, flower in the left hand. I think it's a lotus flower. He's white in color, one face and forearms. His two hands are joined together at his heart, holding a wish-fulfilling gem. His second right hand holds a crystal rosary. His left hand holds a white lotus. He's seated in the cross-legged posture, clothed in fine silk, and is adorned with precious ornaments. An antelope skin covers his left shoulder. On the crown of his head sits Buddha Amitabha. At his crown, throat, and heart are the syllables Om Ahum. He's the essence of the three refuges. So, at Chinrezig, again, there's a giant lotus and a moon seat, and then there's Chinrezig there above us. And at his crown is an Om, which symbolizes, that's the mantra that sort of symbolizes the body. Ah, at his throat, his speech, enlightened speech. And Hum, H-U-M, at the heart, symbolizing enlightened mind. Okay? And then we go, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind, present cause of every type of offering, actual and imagined, declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time, rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please, Guru Buddha, remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn a wheel of Dharma for living beings. Dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. So we're doing this prayer, you know, with this awareness of Chinrezig above our head, and we do the mandala offering, and just imagine that you're offering all the wonderful things in the universe to Chinrezig. You know, again, we're not only purifying our mind by these prayers, but by offering it. Again, this is one of the ways we create merit. So we're offering all these wonderful things, and then at the end of the mandala offering it says Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niryatayami, which is Sanskrit for I send forth this jewel mandala to you precious gurus. And now as prostrations and praise to Chinrezig. So this would have to do with purification. To Arya Chinrezig, whose body is white, unstained by defilements, whose head is adorned with the fully enlightened Buddha Amitabha, you gaze upon all sentient beings with the eyes of boundless compassion. To you, Lord Chinrezig, I prostrate. Now we're going to do the mantra, and I think we can do this out loud for at least 21 times, and then you can do it silently. But here's the visualization. As I make heartfelt prayers, infinite beams of five-colored nectar, white, red, blue, yellow, and green, radiate from the holy body of Chinrezig. The light rays touch me and all sentient beings. The nectar purifies all delusions, negative karma, illnesses, obscurations, and their latencies. The external phenomena become pure, the pure land of Sukhavati. Body, speech, and mind of myself and all beings become the body, speech, and mind of Lord Chinrezig. All appearances, sounds, and awarenesses become inseparable from emptiness. So that's a lot to think about. So don't think about it too much. You know, these light rays radiate out from Chinrezig above the crown of our head, touching us and all the universal living beings surrounding us, and everybody gets transformed into Chinrezig and has all of his enlightened qualities. So this is what we try to do, this visualization as we do the mantra. So with this visualization, you can recite the mantra as many times as you can. And this is a little, it says, meditate on the above visualization as you recite the mantra, imagining that all beings are reciting the mantras together with you. The benefits of reciting the six-syllable mantra in particular are limitless. It eliminates the suffering of the six realms and the six root delusions, anger, greed, pride, doubt, wrong views, and ignorance. In this life, we can receive protection from fear, suffering, sickness, evil spirits, dangers to life, disturbing dreams. The six perfections, generosity, ethics, patience, energy, concentration, and wisdom are attained. In the future, you will be reborn in Sukhavati, the pure land of Amitabha Buddha, and ultimately you will attain the holy body, speech, mind, qualities, and activities of Arya Chinrezig. All right, so we'll do Om Mani Padme Hum, and there's lots of different tunes to it, but we'll do this one. This is the new Christy Minstrel version of it. 21 times. I'll give you a verse. It's just like, goes like this. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Like that. So we'll just do it 21 times, and then you can do it silently. But again, you want to keep your, here's where you keep your body still. You maintain the visualization of Chinrezig, inseparable from your guru. And you say the mantra, using your body, speech, and mind all at the same time, mindfully, and with the intention of developing the qualities of Chinrezig, not only in yourself but all beings. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 pay me home. Oh, money 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 pay me home. When you say mantras silently, you say them so that you can hear them, but the people next to you cannot hear it. You enunciate each word, but it's like, money pay me, money pay me, money pay me, money pay me, money pay me. But you say it kind of under your voice. And again, while you're doing the visualization, so would you just do this just for a minute or two? Dissolution. All the chinrezigs above the heads of myself and all sentient beings melt into light and dissolve into me and each sentient being. The body, speech, and mind of myself and all beings become one with the holy body, speech, and mind of Guru Chinrezig. So just do that visualization. Chinrezig above your head and all other beings that surround you melt into you. And your body, speech, and mind are inseparable from Chinrezig's body, speech, and mind. And in the dedication, due to these merits, may I quickly become Arya Chinrezig and lead all sentient beings to this enlightened realm. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow, and may that born have no decline but increase forevermore. Now let's do Shanti Deva's prayer on 246 as our final dedication tonight. May all beings everywhere, plagued by the suffering of body and mind, attain a notion of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid of a little with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food, may the thirsty find water and delicious drink. May the sorrow find joy, may the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may these never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be free. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, and for as long as sentient beings remain, Until then, may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Thank you. So 6:30 next week. Is that going to work? I mean, if it doesn't, get here as quickly as you can. But, you know, we'll do, I think while we'll do a little bit of review, I think what we'll do is Vajrasattva, and then we'll do Dorji Khandra. So we'll finish off, we'll be clean. Our karmic slate will be clean. Be a good way to wrap it up.
And we're going to have a little party next week.
Yeah, so...
Just a little, okay, huge party.
Are all of our teachers invited?
They are.
Oh.
They are. Well, these four. These two and the other two. Not all of us.